Hill.
Okay.
Okay, I was talking to Patrick. Wait a minute.
Good morning. I'd like to bring the House Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection to order, please. This morning is March 1st, Tuesday, and we have several public hearings today, and we'll be working some amendments on a couple of bills and potentially moving a bill out as well. So with that, I'm going to go right to the top of the agenda and open a public hearing on House Bill 2129. Jan, would you give us a description of this bill, please?
Chairs and members, House Bill 2129, it modifies the process for local governments to make changes to an acknowledged comprehensive plan or land use regulation. Broadens the circumstances in which an appeal of a local governing body decision may be made. Deletes requirement for a public hearing, but allows appeal under certain circumstances if the proposed change is only for the purpose of conforming to statutes, statewide land use planning goal, or an agency rule. It allows DLCD to set a fee that covers the cost of the department's review, and deletes specification that notice has to be mailed.
Thank you. And first up, testifying on this bill, I believe we have Richard Whitman, Bob Rendy, and we'll start out with those two. Good morning, gentlemen. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Co-Chair Holby. For the record, Richard Whitman, the Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development.
I'm Bob Rendy, Policy Analyst with the Department of Land Conservation and Development.
Good morning. If you'd like to give us a description of this bill and why we're bringing this forward and hearing this bill today, and I recognize that you've been working on some amendments, what we thought we would have when we scheduled this, but still don't have those yet. But maybe you could fill us in on that as well.
Okay.
The best you can, anyway.
Thank you, Co-Chair Holby. So what I'm going to do is give you a high-level description of what the bill is, why we're proposing the bill, and what it would do. And then I'll talk briefly about the amendments. There are amendments that are not ready for the hearing today, so we're going to need to come back before you. Stepping up to a high level, I'm not sure all the committee members are familiar with the minutiae of land use decisions, and I'm not going to try to educate you this morning on all of that. But very generally, at a high level, there are a couple of types of land use decisions. There are your everyday land use decisions that are the ones you hear about that are decisions on a permit for a particular type of use. And then there are decisions that amend a local government's comprehensive plan, which says what uses can occur in particular areas. So what we're talking about today are the second type, the plan amendments, when a local government is amending its comprehensive plan. Right now, under current law, local governments, when they do that, are required to provide several types of notice, and this bill deals with the notice provisions for comprehensive plan amendments. They're required to give what's called a 45-day notice, which is 45 days before their first hearing on the proposed amendment to the Department of Land Conservation and Development, which in the notice has to include what it is they're proposing to change in their comprehensive plan. And then they're also required to give an adoption notice. Once they actually adopt the change in their comprehensive plan, they give the department notice of that. Why does current law require that? For a couple of reasons. First of all, DLCD acts as a clearinghouse statewide for folks who are interested in changes to local government comprehensive plans. So we take that notice from local governments and then publish it in a form so that it's accessible to the general public so that they can see what changes are going on in comprehensive plans around the state. And secondly, it's important because part of the department's function is to, we don't review every single plan amendment. There are about 1,500 of these plan amendments that occur every year. We review 300-400 of them, the more significant ones, and often comment to local government on issues as to whether those plan amendments comply with state law. So that's basically the system as it exists right now. So what are the problems that we're trying to fix? Well, there are three of them. One is that often Unfortunately, local governments provide that 45-day notice late. They may be a day late, they may be a couple weeks late, sometimes they're very late. There's no bright line in current law right now in terms of how late a local government can be in providing that notice before it becomes such a problem that if somebody appeals that plan amendment, it'll get sent back. And one thing I should mention is appeals of these things do not come to my agency. They go to the Oregon Land Use Board of Appeals. And there are a couple of hundred land use appeals filed every year. I don't have an exact number, but a relatively small proportion of those are appeals of plan amendments. But we do see a fair number of cases where citizens appeal a plan amendment over a technicality, late notice, or a notice that failed to describe what it is that the local government's doing. And the Land Use Board of Appeals, if it's too late or if there's too much of a change in what's being proposed, will send it back to the local government to re-notice and redo it at the local level. So those two problems, late notice and then changes in what's being proposed, are two of the things that we're trying to take that gray area in terms of how late you can be and how much you can change and draw some either bright lines or at least brighter lines so that local government knows what the rules are and citizens have a better sense of what the rules are, and we have a little bit more certainty and predictability in our system. The third problem that we're trying to fix is a little bit different, and that is that the legislature and the Land Conservation and Development Commission change our land use laws from time to time. And when they do that, local governments typically are required to take the changes that you make here in Salem and adopt corresponding changes in local codes in land use. And when they do that, right now, they're required to hold a public hearing and have people come in and testify on those changes, even though those changes are required by statute or, in some cases, by rule. That creates a lot of confusion, a lot of unhappiness when people hear we're required to do this by the state, and, frankly, a lot of delay and expense in our system. So this legislation also would authorize local governments, when they're required to adopt a conforming change to a change in state law, at their option — this is not required, but at their option — to do that without holding a public hearing. So that's basically the bill that's being proposed. We have worked this with a work group made up of representatives of both local government and various interests in the land use system. We have some changes that cities in particular are asking be made in form of amendments to the bill. We're still talking to the cities about those changes. We need to have a few more discussions. So we're not quite there yet. I will say it's important to the agency that this be a consensus bill. I'm not interested in moving a bill that has controversy from local government or from other land use interests. So we'll continue to talk to the cities, work those amendments. I hope we'll be back before you in a couple of weeks with the last tweaks to this bill. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions from the committee? Mr. Rindy, do you have any anything, or are you just along to answer questions as well?
Yes, I'm mostly here for questions. I did want to note that one of the things we're trying to do with this that we didn't mention is we're moving more and more to an electronic notice system. So that's a feature of this. Arguably, it's to some extent allowed today, and a lot of it is being done that way, but very clear that that's what we want to move towards.
Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you kind of just paint a picture for us, describe maybe something that's happening right now, the case that's in front of you, where the timeline is really long, and what that might look like under this bill, how that would change?
Sure. Co-Chair Holvey, Representative Sheehan, I'll try to do that. I think the best way I can illustrate this is to talk a little bit about a case that's actually been appealed already and decided by the Land Use Board of Appeals, sent back to the local government. It sort of illustrates what the problem is. So this is a City of Portland case. City of Portland proposed to amend its comprehensive plan for the Portland Zoo. You're all familiar with the zoo. You've all visited there and parked in the parking lot there, and some of you have probably ridden on the light rail system. When the City of Portland was going through the planning process for the parking lot, some changes to the parking lot and the entry to the zoo, they needed to amend their comprehensive plan. And so they gave notice to the department that they were going to amend their comprehensive plan. They had to do that 45 days before they could even have their first hearing. And then they started to hold hearings on this proposal. And like a lot of things are in Portland, it's controversial. And so they ended up making some changes in what was being proposed. In particular, there were some changes, I believe, in the parking lot that were not in the original notice to the department. So they went forward, and they made those changes in part in response to public testimony. The system's working the way it should. We want to hear from citizens and be able to react to that. After the plan amendment was adopted, it was appealed to the Land Use Board of Appeals, and one of the bases for the appeal was you made changes and allowed an aspect of the parking lot in the plan amendment that was not in the notice that you provided to the state. And so there was a defective notice, and the argument was you've got to start over again and re-notice it. And they actually succeeded with that argument in the Land Use Board of Appeals. That's the type of problem that we would like to avoid. We'd like to draw some brighter lines about changes that local governments can make in response to citizen input without having to start the process over again. We're also, the 45-day piece, and specifically to your question, the timing, this bill would shorten that 45-day period to a not to exceed 35 days and as little as 20 days. So it's also streamlining, shortening the amount of time it takes to get through the process so we can get these decisions made more quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Not seeing any other land use questions coming from the dais at this point, I appreciate your testimony. It'll give us a kind of a primer for looking at this bill a little more thoroughly and looking at your amendments. I hope you're successful in bringing back your anticipated consensus bill. Before you leave, though, what happens if you don't get that consensus? The current state of affairs, I guess, continues.
Co-Chair Holvey, I think that's right. As I said, the agency will not move this bill unless we can get consensus on this, and we'll continue with the current state of affairs. We'll continue, frankly, working this issue to try to improve the system. I think there's good work to be done there to do this. If we can't get there this session, we'll be back at it again.
So the current statutes, you don't feel allow this bright line that you're speaking of to be drawn?
Co-Chair Holvey, no. The land use, it's basically been done through litigation before the Land Use Board of Appeals, and the decisions of the Land Use Board of Appeals are fine, but they don't give clear guidance either to cities or to citizens about what the rules are, and that's what we're trying to do.
Well, thank you. I applaud your efforts in this and in helping to get that bright line and streamline this process a little bit more. Thank you very much for your testimony. Next up, I have Linda Ludwig. Good morning. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. I appreciate the opportunity to talk a little bit about the amendments to 2129. We had city representation on the work group that Mr. Whitman described, and the amendments that were submitted to Legislative Council that we reviewed, the draft amendments, we supported fairly wholeheartedly. There is one provision that we are having a problem with, and if you would like me to describe that so that you would know, I certainly can at this point in time. If you'd like me, for consideration of time, to continue to have discussions with DLCD, we certainly are very...
If you could give us just a couple minutes describing what the outstanding issue is, I think that'd be helpful for the committee going forward.
As you heard from Mr. Whitman, the nexus of this bill was to streamline and provide some efficiencies both for state and local government and create a more transparent process for everyone, including people that are participating or affected by local government decisions through the appeals process. The concern that we have in the standing provision of the amendment. The standing provision today, which is included in the amendment, would say that for significant changes to a comprehensive plan amendment, as local government is going through the process, significant changes to the notice that local government has provided to DLCD, if... Let me backtrack in my brain a little bit here. Excuse me. For those significant changes, if appealed, that DLCD may appeal or any persons may appeal that process, whether or not they participated below in the local government hearings. That's consistent today, and we believe that should be consistent going forward. What the bill or the amendment to the bill would add to that would be a further allowance of anyone to appeal whether they were participated below or not in the notice provision, whether it included all of the provisions in the new legislation. If something was missing under the amendment, then all persons, including persons that did not participate below, could appeal at any time. Also, if the local government was one day late in providing the notice, any person, including persons that were not affected and not participating below, could appeal. We think that is a much more stringent standard, much more onerous standard, given that the notice requirements in this amendment are substantially greater than what they are today and require more discretion on the local government's part. What we're concerned with that appeal standard is that we will see actually this not be an effective efficiency measure. We'll have many, many more appeals, and that local governments we'll just see many more appeals. So
thank you. I think that lays it out for us very well. I appreciate that, and I know that the committee doesn't have the amendments, but it sort of gives us an idea of what the outstanding issue is, so we'll be able to talk about it a little bit better going forward and look forward to seeing the amendment. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Linda, the director talked about AOC and LOC are at the table, and I think, you know, I like all the changes. The one that concerns me is maybe number three, today's trial lawyer day in the Capitol. So my question is, are Mr. Dewey or Honeycutt, are they part of this group that's looking at the bill to be sure, representing some of the citizens as we draft this bill? And I think the objective is good, but I wonder if we need to have them at the table to talk about this, too. I mean, I could have asked that of the director.
Mr. Co-Chair, I do not know if they've actually been party to seeing the amendments as they are currently drafted.
I gave both sides, Honeycutt and Dewey. So.
Thank you very much for your testimony this morning. Appreciate you coming forward. I know I got a note. Doug Riggs would like to speak to the bill briefly as well. Good morning. morning. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Doug Riggs on behalf of the Central Oregon Cities Organization. I'm handing out some testimony, very short, brief testimony. We had hoped that someone from Central Oregon would be here this morning, but the snow on the pass is apparently exceeding 3 feet overnight, so discretion is the better part of valor, and our local planners decided not to brave the mountain pass. I'll be very brief, and I'm just going to read testimony by Mayor George Innicott from Redmond. COCO took a look at this bill a couple weeks ago at the request of Central Oregon Cities Organization. Took a look at the bill a couple weeks ago at the request of Representative Wisnett. Our initial reaction was positive. It doesn't do everything we'd like to do in the land use process, but it's certainly a step in the right direction. So we support the adoption of House Bill 2129 as amended. The bill proposes several important changes to ORS 197 that would streamline and clarify the process local governments follow in submitting PAPA amendments to the Department of Land Conservation and Development. In particular, the bill eases notice requirements to DLCD, clarifies submittal requirements to the department, and clarifies standing to appeal. In addition, the Central Oregon Cities support two additional amendments to the bill. First, COCO recommends amending Section 1 to eliminate the discretion, the direction to LCDC for rulemaking, and simply incorporate the proposed changes in the timing of notice in the statute. Second, COCO recommends adding a new section of the bill that will have the effect of adding and amending ORS 197-835-3 to refer post-acknowledgement plan amendments subject to 197-610 through 197-625. This amendment would apply the raise it or waive it provisions and apply to land use decisions on the PAPAs. It's a complicated section, something I think we ought to talk with the department about. I've given them a copy of the amendment, and it's probably something we can work out. But in essence, we're trying to apply the same standard that you have to raise an issue during the process to be able to appeal it at some later point. So it's a consistency issue for us. It would hopefully cut down on the number of appeals, the number of objections that are raised later in the process, and therefore streamline the process in general. Thank you.
Thank you for that. I appreciate your comments, and I'll look forward to the amendment. I do have one sort of question about that. I mean, if you keep restricting it further and further, I mean, at some point, aren't you going to have the non-consensus come up with people saying, you know, we don't even have the ability to appeal? And I worry that if you go too far, then the consensus goes away. So, but I appreciate that. I hope you're able to discuss those issues with the LCDC and Bob Rendy and work with the stakeholders to come up with something, because I think this is a good bill, and I hope we can at least get consensus on getting it through, whether or not we get all of your concerns with PAPA done or not.
Great.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 2129? Not seeing any, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2129 and open a hearing on the next one. I lost my paper. And the next one is... I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2248. Jan, would you give us a description of House Bill 2248, please?
House Bill 2248 is from the Secretary of State's office. They want to remove the requirement for the Secretary to audit the governor-elect's expenses incurred prior to taking office. They want to remove the requirement for the Secretary of State to audit claims against the War Veterans Bond Sinking Account, and remove the requirement for the Secretary of State to annually audit the expenses of the Department of Aviation. And although the bill eliminates the mandate to audit in all three instances, the Secretary of State still maintains the right to audit.
Thank you. And so, committee, let's invite up Gary Blackmere to explain this removal of requirements and moving to a different method of approaching these audits of these particular agencies and why. So, good morning. Welcome, and if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you for inviting me, Co-Chairs Hovey and Wisnett. My name is Gary Blackmer. I'm the Director of Audits in the Secretary of State's office, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak in favor of this bill. There are many areas we could audit in the state, and we try our best to apply our resources to the areas that most need audits. And we identified some areas in the statutes where we're mandated to conduct audits that are unusual circumstances, and to a certain degree they draw our resources toward areas that are of less critical nature than others that need auditing. And what we would like to be able to do is apply our risk analysis and look at these areas to determine whether we really need to audit them at all or in the detail that's mandated in the audits. For example, the government or the governor elects claims against the state. We believe that that was actually initiated before there were transition budgets. And for us to audit all necessary expenses of the governor-elect prior to taking office is a matter that, I guess, number one, I'm concerned we might miss those expenses and violate statutes by not auditing. But number two, being able to look at those expenses if issues arise in the course of the governor-elect's practices, then we would still have that authority to audit. Secondly, there are audits of claims against the Veterans Sinking Fund, and we actually audit that every year as part of our annual financial audit. So to the degree that this is asking us to do something that we routinely do, we felt it was a housekeeping matter to remove it as a mandated audit since it's automatically done as part of our annual financial statement. The last area is the Department of Aviation. While it may not require an annual audit, we end up having to look at every year's expenses because of the way the language is worded. It says that all necessary expenses shall be audited. So it doesn't necessarily segregate it year by year. So if we do an audit every 2 years or every three years, we still have to go back to preceding year's audits. And I guess one other thing that we've been looking and noticing is many of these have the phrase audit necessary expenses. To our interest, we'd rather also audit the unnecessary expenses and spend a little time on that. So we are taking out the word necessary and just saying we will audit all expenses. But in these cases, what we'd like to do is replace the word shall with the phrase shall be open to inspection and audit by the Secretary of State. Excuse me. This still preserves our right to go in and audit where we warrant an audit is necessary and apply our resources more appropriately. So thank you for the opportunity to speak on this, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions from the committee? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just for the record, and if you end up having to repeat something, I apologize, but just help us be clear that this won't reduce, excuse me, any sort of level of fiscal responsibility or rigor or discipline in any of these three agencies and departments.
It would not, when we conduct an audit in these areas, we would conduct it as we would normally conduct an audit. The question is whether we would need to do audit an area like this or one that might be a larger dollar expenditure, higher risk for Oregonians, or an area where we can actually leverage our audit resources to identify risks that are out there in terms of fraud, waste, or abuse. So this draws us to certain areas where we would may not get the best value from our audit dollars.
Follow up. So do I understand correctly then that there are of the agencies, there are certain agencies that you have that are sort of permissive and then certain that are required, and you'd rather, and there may be bigger, more juicy agencies that are permissive, and so you're not required to do those, but you are required to do these, and so you'd want more sort of parity. Am I understanding that world right, or am I misunderstanding it?
Co-Chair Hovey, Representative Smith, yes, that's it precisely.
Okay. Thanks.
Never thought of an agency as juicy, but I appreciate it. Other questions, Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Blackmer, will you please speak to the amendment? And second question is, I understand the transition budget for the governor-elect and the aviation department, that's in the budgets, and we get to review those in ways and means. Could you tell me what the War Veterans Sinking Fund, how much money is in that? And how else is that looked at, if not by the Secretary of State? I understand you can do it as required, but...
Co-Chair Wisnant, the, in terms of the Veterans Sinking Fund, it is a fund where money is set aside as a guarantee for the bonds to ensure that they can be paid even in financial circumstances that might be difficult for the state. So it's a reserve fund, essentially. And we do audit that every year to determine its balance. I don't know the amount off the top of my head of that fund. I know that those activities have declined in recent years. I don't know what the, and I think the sinking fund has maintained adequate levels through all those years, but
terrible name for a fund, sinking fund.
And in terms of an amendment, we don't have an amendment to this bill. It's as it stands.
So is it ready?
I think that was my misunderstanding.
Okay.
I thought they were asking for one.
Okay, so we didn't schedule it for a workshop, though.
So you're not seeking an amendment to this bill, then, to clarify?
Co-Chair Holvey, no, we are not.
Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Not seeing any on this. Jan, I don't believe we have a fiscal on this.
That's correct, sir.
So, I appreciate your testimony, and certainly if any other questions about the bill pop up from the committee, I'm sure they'll be trying to get a hold of you.
Thank you, Chair. Co-Chair Holvey.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else that wished to testify on House Bill 2248? Not seeing any, I will close public hearing on House Bill 2248 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3005. Jan, would you give us a little short description of the bill, as long as you're able?
Of a short bill. Chairs and committee members, House Bill 3005, it defines and sets standards for certificates of insurance for property and casual insurance coverage, casualty insurance coverage. It gives the certificate holder rights of notice if the holder is included within the policy as an additional insured. It allows an insurer to charge a fee for issuing a certificate. It gives the director of the DCBS the power to investigate perceived prohibitive practices. And it allows the director to adopt rules regulating issuance of the certificates.
Great. If I could have up Roger Beyer and Ed Davis. Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome to the committee this morning.
Good morning.
If you'd identify yourself ahead of your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the Independent Agents and Brokers of Oregon. I bring to you House Bill 3005 and the -1 amendment with the bill. I will be very brief and let Ed Davis, whose testimony you should be being passed out to you, go in further detail on the bill. The bill here and with the -1 amendments is an attempt to put some clarity into Oregon certificate law and how those are issued and who and kind of the practice thereof. The bill was drafted as a model legislation from the Independent Agents and Brokers of America, and after it was drafted, I started meeting with insurance companies here in Oregon and representatives of the national companies to try to better conform the bill to Oregon law, as the national models don't always fit our statutory scheme here. So the 3005-1 amendments is would be what would be left of the bill after the we've had those discussions and come to agreements with the insurance carriers in the state. Very briefly, with the amendment, the only things left in the bill would be subsection 2, 5, or section 2, sub 5, sub 7, sub 8, sub 9, and sub 10. The rest of the bill would be deleted. You may have heard from the insurance division that they think that maybe a little more of the bill should be left in, so we will have conversations with her after the meeting to discuss that. I think clearly was an oversight on my part to take section 3 out of the bill and the amendment that puts in the when the bill would be applicable, what policies and certificates it would be applicable to. That certainly should be left in the bill. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Let Mr. Davis tell a little more about the need for the bill from his perspective as an insurance producer.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Edward Davis. I've been employed in the insurance industry since 1965, God help me. And I'm currently a senior account executive with MAPS Insurance Services here in Salem. I'm testifying today as a director, member, and legislative chair for the Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers of Oregon. With due respect to your literary skills, I won't read the testimony verbatim. I'll let you go through that at your convenience. In general, certificates of insurance are intended to be a summary or a brief snapshot of insurance coverage that's in effect at the time the certificate is issued. Many parties have a legitimate need to be assured that insurance is in force, and a commonplace is in construction agreements where if you're having a project built for you by a contractor, you want to be sure that that contractor has adequate insurance. And so there are many cases with landlords and tenants, users of property, where there are legitimate needs to know that insurance is in effect. Over the years, however, there have been, and especially in the construction arena, there have been attempts by users of certificates to convert them from simply descriptions of coverage as they existed at a given point in time to a form of contract between the certificate holder and the issuer of the certificate. They've attempted to introduce language into certificates to require the insurance company to extend coverage to them for periods of time that aren't warranted in the policy. And there's been a number of cases that have led Division Administrator Teresa Miller to issue a bulletin and a few months ago kind of reminding us in the industry that violation of some of the rules of certificates is a violation of the Oregon Insurance Code as it exists. As the bill was originally drafted, it was intended not only to clarify these rules regarding certificates, but also to prohibit one particular attempt by users of certificates to require insurance agents to issue opinion letters assuring the user that the coverage being presented satisfied the requirements of, for example, a bid specification. Attempting to transfer the requirement of reviewing and evaluating the coverage from the user to the agent and the relating liability. Agents, in many cases, have been unwilling to assume that liability on behalf of the certificate holder, who is someone with whom we have no relationship, no business connections at all, other than on behalf of our clients. The third attempt in the bill, which has been removed, had to do with guaranteed notification to certain parties of changes in coverage. We have reviewed that language as it was originally drafted and determined that it needs a lot more tweaking before going forward. So to avoid creating more problems than we were solving, we've decided to fight that battle another day. The reason for the Dash 1 amendments had primarily to do with the feeling that the insurance division at this point does not need to take on additional workload of reviewing and approving certificate forms, although we think that's something that would be worthwhile down the road. And in that context, we've not gone as far as we would like to go eventually, but in this case, we'd like to clarify the point of certificates and what they really are and how they work, and to eliminate the position that agents are in when asked to provide opinions that go beyond what a certificate should normally provide. We will be working with the insurance division to review and accommodate some of the comments we've received from them regarding adapting the bill even more effectively to Oregon law as it's written. So there may be another amendment before you, before too long. So with that, I am certainly open to any questions that you may have.
Questions from the committee? Representative Smith.
Talk to me about the opinion letter piece. why, under what circumstances does somebody get one, and how are they used or abused?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, a typical situation would be in a construction bid specification where a contractor would like to bid on a particular project. The bid specification includes a litany of required insurance coverages, amendments, endorsements for the benefit of the owner of the project, and included with the requirement, perhaps in a pre-qualification process, would be a requirement that the bidder submit an opinion letter from his insurance agent assuring the owner of the project that the bidder's insurance completely meets all of the required specifications in the bid. And again, what that does is it in effect says that if at some point down the road the insurance coverage that's submitted doesn't comply in every respect, then that puts the insurance agent on the hook to the owner for having provided some kind of professional advice without compensation. So our position is that if they, you know, we'd be happy to show them what the coverage is that our client has. It's up to them to determine whether it's adequate for their needs or not.
Up to whom to determine whether it's adequate
up
for their needs?
Up to the owner of the project. Let's say, for example, I'm representing a building contractor, and that building contractor is asked to bid on a building project. The owner of the project and their advisors will have established certain requirements that they want to make sure that builder carries certain insurance to protect them in the process. Our position is that it should not be the builder's insurance agent who is making the determination as to whether the builder's coverage does or does not meet the building owner's needs. Our client is the contractor. Our responsibility is to make sure it meets the contractor's needs. The building owner should be relying on their own advisors to determine whether the coverage meets their needs. And our client should not be required to, in effect, demand that his agent provide that service to the building owner for no compensation and to take on that responsibility without really knowing what the building owner's risk situation is.
So what if I want to be really sure? So I understand if I'm the person who's not represented by you, but you're not really a lawyer, insurance carrier, so it's a little different.
Exactly.
And I want to be really sure that it's covered. I can have my own advisor tell me, well, we're real sure, but I don't have a deal with you. So what do I do to make real sure?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, there are a couple of options you have. One is to ask your advisor to review the certificate of insurance, and if they have any questions about it, they always have the option of requesting a certified copy of the contractor's policy. And we see some cases where building owners actually do reserve the right to request a full copy of the policy for their own review.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So, you know, I have reviewed more than one insurance policy. I have come away occasionally clear. Okay. So if I said, hey, is it covered, and somebody hands me a policy, right, then I'm, you know, I don't know if my question is answered or not. So you feel free to respond to that, but I still come away with a little bit of doubt about if I want to be really sure, right, and, you know, so promote commerce, make sure deals can happen, you know, make sure people have confidence that there's not, you know, unmitigated risk. I still have questions about that.
Any other questions? So to follow up on his question, so what is the value of the certificate of insurance if it's being provided as as I, Mr. Contractor, says to somebody who's performing work for me, I need you to have this kind of coverage and make sure this is coverage, and then they hand you a certificate of insurance that says it's covered. I mean, what value is there in that certificate if it can't be relied upon?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the certificate of insurance can be relied upon in terms of assuring that a particular form of coverage is in place at the time the certificate is issued. The coverage forms are described and any deviation from standard industry coverage language is intended to be identified in the remarks section, or copies of modifying endorsements, exclusions, those kinds of things are supposed to be added to the certificate so that it does fairly represent and gives the user of the certificate a way to obtain copies of standard policy form language if they choose to get into it more fully. What we find is that the cases where the requirements become most onerous is from large contractors, large users, people who have very sophisticated risk management advisors who are more than capable of making those evaluations on their own. We very seldom find issues in cases where you and I as normal folks rely on one another to do the right thing. It's an issue of larger users of certificates simply attempting to transfer as much of the risk as they can to someone else. And we as insurance agents would rather not be on the receiving end of that risk transfer when we don't have we aren't in a position to make those kinds of judgments.
So appreciate that. The bill also talks, you know, to certificates of insurance, and it's my understanding that this is just property and casualty insurance. And I mean, what other types of insurance could be fall under this certificate of insurance? I mean, if you're talking about a construction project, you have, you know, workers' comp, you've got all other sorts of types of insurance. So is this bill broadly covers just anything, any type of insurance, or is it pretty restrictive to the type of insurance it's talking about?
Dr. Hovey, that's one of the comments we received from Teresa Miller's office, is that she would like us to clarify and specify more clearly what the intent is. Certificates of insurance are, in my experience, used primarily in the property and casualty field, which would extend to workers' compensation, property liability policies, builder's risk, contractor's equipment forms, any number of property and casualty policies. In my experience, we have not seen them used with life insurance or group health insurance policies. So it's strictly a property and casualty question for the most part. But we will be trying to clarify that in response to the administrator's request.
Thank you. Not seeing any other questions this morning, gentlemen. Thanks for elaborating on this bill a little bit for us.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Lana Butterfield and Mike Bibi. I should have just said Mike. Good morning, and if you'd identify yourself for the record before you give your testimony, please.
Good morning, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lana Butterfield, and today I've brought a constituent of Representative Matthews to talk to you, and we're going to try to explain in a little more detail what the problem is for insurance agents.
Co-Chair Hovey and committee. My name is Mike Bibi. I'm a principal of Stamster Bibi Insurance Agency in the Gresham area. I've been in the property casualty field for over 30 years. I've been acting as a property casualty independent agent since 1985. I'm representing the professional independent insurance agents, and the PIA is a statewide independent agent association. The intent of House Bill 3005 is to address a number of long-term problems that have seems to have progressively become more an issue as in the last decade in particular. The PIA does not support the original bill, House 3005 as written, but it does support the House Bill 3005-1 amendment. The heart of the problem really has to do with in the process of issuing a certificate, the general contractors and project owners, typically of more sophisticated projects, are looking and tending to use a certificate as an expanded or a venue to expand the policy terms and conditions to how they would like it structured. And this is problematic because what the policy, the way it's designed, is the policies and endorsements would accompany that certificate, and the policy endorsements are the governing agreement. And the certificate is just merely a reflection of what is in those policies and endorsements. But with the more sophisticated projects, you'll see some customary indemnification language, hold harmless agreements. You know, I've seen a request where it may be take an 8.5 by 11 page, and it's a whole half a page that we would add in the comments section of the certificate. So then I'm stuck in the middle as an agent because my subcontractor is saying, "Hey, Mike, let's get the certificate. I want to get the work done." And I tell my subcontractor, it says, "Well, right now with the language that they're asking for, it doesn't comply with your insurance policy." Of course, they go back to the general contract, and the general contractor says, "I don't know what the problem is. I get language like this all the time." So there's this situation where you're cut in the middle. So often, I find myself acting on behalf of my subcontractor with the attempt to solve the problem by entering the negotiations with the general contractor and assisting the subcontractor. So now I'm in this precarious situation. Am I standing in the boundaries of an insurance agent, or am I crossing this line as practicing law? It's just a very inefficient, ugly situation. In other cases, I've seen where contracts will ask for obsolete or antiquated insurance forms be attached to the certificate. The policy that the subcontractor has may be very similar to, include a lot of the terms, but is it the form they're requesting? No. And yet then the other thing is with regard to subpoena letters. I think the issue that the agents have, and I know I personally, is I just assume I'll be representing my client and more than happy to let the general contractor's advisors represent their client, and that's where the line should stay. I'll give them the whole policy. Their advisors can analyze within their purview of their expertise, and they can give advice to their client. But let it stay within those boundaries. And finally, some of the certificates that requests that I've seen is they're actually asking for a guarantee that notices are going to be set out, which again is extending beyond the limits and guidelines of the policy. There's no guarantees in that sense. They're going to go through the normal business practices and make every good faith effort to do so. Finally, what I see is the House Bill 35 is it's just a solution to help ease this conflict. Certainly make an attempt to get closer to making that marketplace of issuing certificates a little more efficient, because then at this point in time, as agents, we can go back to the parties, the subcontractor and the contractor, and say, okay, point to the statute. The statute says what you can ask for, who is to ask for it, both the contractor and the agent, and it sets the boundaries and the rules that all the players need to be working within.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Smith.
So I apologize that I find this interesting. It's not good for anybody. It's not good for me. It's not good for anybody. So in figuring out who the best risk bearer is, there are various sort of legitimate criteria for that. One is the best possessor of information. You know, she who knows most. is, and I hear part of the argument is, yeah, this is, you know, we're not worried about grandma not knowing what's in her insurance policy. We're, you know, somebody who's got a team of lawyers and whether their team of lawyers should be paying attention to their team of lawyers. And that's, I understand that. Is there anything in the bill that limits the ambit of the bill to sort of larger, sophisticated projects and parties?
Co-Chair Holvey and Representative Smith, I'm going to, at that point, defer to Lana, as she's been more involved in the basics of the bill. I was just brought here to talk about the nature of the process of issuing certificates.
I think it's the nature of the certificate itself, because it's the folks who are asking for these certificates that it would involve. Does that make sense?
I understand the answer, yeah.
Thank you. I'm not seeing anybody else on the committee who finds this as interesting as Representative Smith. But I do appreciate it. It is an interesting topic to some degree in trying to figure out what exactly certificates of insurance are and what value they are and why do we have them. So I guess I'm just going to ask you the question, why would you use a certificate of insurance instead of just giving the general contractor a copy of the policy and let them look through it themselves?
Well, I suppose, Co-Chair Holvey, and I suppose that's why we grow trees, because you're talking about a volume and volume of documents and paperwork. The whole purpose of the certificate, within the context of the policy, a lot of policies, I would say 85% of them, are governed by the insurance service offices. They're standard contracts. The endorsements, in many cases, are standard endorsements. They're endorsements that we all within the industry and the respective advisors rely on the fact that they are standardized. So there's an expectation. So if you can report those standard agreements, it's a simple purview. It's a quick look, and we're off and going. Where it becomes inefficient is where you get into all this unique language that may expand or swing the table of risk transfer to one party or the other. That's when everything slows down, and there's just a very slow process to work through that.
So not that you know, anybody would be real anxious to get a whole policy to examine it, but does that happen?
No, sure, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So I mean, that ability still would be, you know, the general contractor say, I got to see your policy because I can't tell whether you're covered or not.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holley, absolutely.
Okay, thank you. Representative Cameron.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, not a question, but comment. I know, having experienced this in multi-situations, I've had, for example, landlords request more than a certificate and always can pass that on to the landlord. You know, being a restaurateur, having multi-units, you want to have a certificate. They ask for a certificate, you send it to them, and they say, well, this isn't good enough, and they get more information.
Yeah.
At their request.
Absolutely.
All right.
Oh, crap.
Uh-oh.
Spark some more interest. You thought we were done with this bill. Representative Smith.
Apologize. So right now it seems like the function of the certificate serves is to some degree speed, right? So I had a shorter thing say, yeah, it's covered, rather than a big long policy and saying, figure it out. Mm-hmm. If I have a certificate that I know is more or less toothless, it seems like it obviates its utility. It seems like all of a sudden, okay, thanks for this, but I still got to read the bigger thing, and that slows me down, and you know, kills jobs. I don't know, but that would be my question. What use would the certificate still have if I can't really rely upon it?
Co-Chair Holvey, Representative Smith, often when a project owner or a general contractor, because usually this happens in construction, it happens a lot also with tenant relationships too. Usually what's happening is they are looking for core elements in the policy, and then if they're looking for some specific indemnification language that is a little bit more expansive, They will spell out the nature of how that should be expanded. Then within that certificate that we accompany, we refer to in the certificate the actual endorsement that addresses their language request with certificate. So then again, it's still in a snapshot. We're still talking 5-6 pieces of paper. But all we're doing, again, is reflecting the policy. So we have these standardized terms on the certificate, these unique terms that you're asking for, they're in the accompanying pages along with the certificate. So if the language doesn't accompany the certificate, that omission right there would tell the requester of the information that it's not adequate.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate you traveling down from Gresham. I hear that there was a lot of snow and ice up there this morning where they were shutting the city down. So I don't know what state Gresham is in, but it's still a great concern. And thank you for braving the weather to get here. Okay. Appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, I want to say thank you to Mr. Bobby. We had a chance to meet during the interim, and I appreciated that time and clarification on things that are important to your industry, but look forward to continually keeping in touch. But I do want it noted, was it not snowing in Gresham this morning?
Co-Chair Holby, Representative Matthews, absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for the comment, Representative Matthews. So with that, I know Teresa Miller is from the Insurance Division is in the audience, and I know you're not signed up to testify, but I got a note someone would like to ask you a question, if you wouldn't mind coming up. And I appreciate you being here, and I guess guessing that we may have a question for you.
I appreciate being here.
You'd identify yourself for the record, please.
For the record, my name is Teresa Miller. I'm the administrator of the Oregon Insurance Division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services.
Thank you. Representative Wisnett.
Do you support Dash 2, Mrs. Miller?
Mr. Co-Chair, I'm not aware that there are Dash 2 amendments.
Dash 1.
The Dash 1 amendments. With the Dash 1 amendments, we still do have some concerns, as I think the proponents of the bill noted. So we would plan to work with them and try to address those concerns.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your testimony.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. No other questions? With that, this bill of interest, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3005 unless there's someone else in the audience that wished to testify.
Representative Smith, is he okay?
Seeing none, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 3005. And we will open a... Do we have amendments we can adopt?
Uh-huh.
So we'll open a work session on House Bill 2244.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
I move the Dash 2s into House Bill 2244.
Representative Wisnett moves the Dash 2 amendments dated
2/25/2011
be adopted into House Bill 2244. Before we have discussion, Jan, could you tell us a little bit about this bill to remind the committee and what the Dash 2 amendments may do?
Yes, chairs and committee members. House Bill 2244, we had a public hearing on February 10th. This is the Secretary of State's bill that expands the definition of public record to include information in any form. There was concerns about needing to exclude the Department of Justice, and they had Dash 2 amendments drafted, and I believe they are here to speak about those Dash 2 amendments.
Thank you. And with that, could we have someone from the Secretary of State's office who feels like talking about this morning? Good morning and welcome to the committee this morning. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Beth Herkert, and I'm the director of the State Archives Division of the Secretary of State. The Dash 2 amendments for House Bill 2244 make it so that We worked with the Department of Justice on having a single definition of a public record that would work for both their section of the law, which is 192.405, and our section of the law, which is 192.005, recognizing that there is a slight difference dealing with retention and disposition and access, and so that's what these Dash 2 amendments for that part of the bill look at and clarify. And then the second part of the amendments deal with the inadvertent inclusion of the Judicial Department as a state agency. In the early 90s, they were removed from the definition of a state agency over our purview, although we worked cooperatively with them, and we just wanted to correct that and make it very clear that they do not fall under these definitions, as they have their own definitions that they work with public record.
Thank you. So I assume that the Justice Department or the Judicial Department is also here and may want to comment or may not. I don't know. And they don't, but I imagine making sure that we didn't turn them into a state agency was of interest to them. So I can you tell me a little bit, just briefly in general, with the adopted amendment, basically this bill's intent, just to, so the committee understands what 2244 is going to do.
Okay. Co-Chair Holby, the intent of this bill is to bring the definition of a public record into the 21st century. The original definition that we've been working with all these years was originally written in 1961. The one for retention and disposition, the one for access, was written in 1973. And because technology has advanced so much to the point where we have limped along with the definition and made it work with electronic records, but now with the advent of such things as social media, it makes it virtually impossible to apply retention and disposition under the current definition to make it work and actually allow agencies to use the media to any degree successfully without violating the law, because with social media, we lose things such as ownership and control over how long the information is being kept by the vendors and the suppliers of that media, such as Facebook, Twitter, YouTube. And so what this does is it makes the definition really technology independent and allows us a little bit more flexibility of ensuring that public records remain public records and that we can apply retention and disposition and that they're also accessible to the general public.
Thank you. I appreciated that more general description. Questions from the committee? Representative Conger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there, looking at the bill, it seems that the definition of public record, while definitely being modernized, could extend to information that is is private. That's the wrong way to say that. Let me restate that. Could relate to information that is generated by a private party, not a public agency. Because the new definition of public record, I'm just going to read the amended definition, means any information in any form capable of retention by a custodian that relates to an activity, transaction, or function of a public body, or is necessary to satisfy the fiscal, legal, administrative, or historic policies, requirements, or needs of the public body. So is it possible that a record that is, or a piece of information that's created by a private party, not a public agency, could fall under that definition?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Conger, yes, and under the current law it can too. If a private party submits something to a public entity and requires action on it by the public entity, it does. In the previous definition, it still fell under the definition of a public record, and under this current definition it would, because it requires the public entity to do something to it or respond to it.
So, but I think implicit, I'm sorry, follow up. Implicit in what you're saying is that before it's submitted to the public body, it wouldn't fall under this definition.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Conger, right, correct. unless they submit it to the public body, it would not be a public record. It has to be in the custody of the public entity in order for it to, and the public entity has to respond to it for it to be a public record.
I don't see that requirement in the definition. I guess I'm a little bit concerned that maybe unintentionally, or I may be misinterpreting what it says, but it doesn't say it has to be in the possession of a public body. It says any information in any form capable of retention by a custodian that relates to an activity, transaction, or function of a public body and is necessary to satisfy the fiscal, legal, administrative, or historic policies, requirements, or needs of the public body. I don't see that as saying it has to be in the possession of the public or submitted into the public record.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Conger, the intent is that it has to be something that the public body reacts to, and that's why those are all ands and not ors. So it would have to meet the conditions of all three in order for it to be considered a public record, as opposed to just meeting the conditions of one of those statements.
May I follow up one more time?
Certainly.
So information, you're right, there's three requirements. The first is that it's in a form capable of retention by a custodian.
Correct.
That means anything, right? I mean, it could be electronic, could be in writing. So that's not a particularly difficult criteria to meet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's intentionally broad, and I understand that. It should be. The second is relates to an activity, transaction, or function of a public body.
Correct.
That could be anything, a building permit, I'm trying to think of something that's not as obvious as public testimony, right? Of course that's a public record, but that's been submitted. So I'm trying to think of, you know, is there information that relates to an activity, transaction, or a public or function of a public body that is not necessarily something that's submitted publicly? If I wrote, as an attorney, if I wrote, let's say, an opinion letter to a client that related to an interpretation of a statute regarding the taking of their property, that would relate to a transaction or function of a public body in the sense that there's condemnation going on. But it's an attorney-client privileged document. And then, is necessary to satisfy the fiscal, legal, administrative, or historic policies, requirements, or needs of the public body, the fact that I gave a legal opinion about whether or not the condemnation was legal certainly relates to the legal, administrative, policies, requirements, or needs of the public body, but it's not something that was submitted into the record, nor is it should it be publicly available. So maybe I'm picking nits, but it seems to me that the definition is a little bit overbroad in the sense that it doesn't have that last piece that you said, which is it's submitted into the record or generated by a public agency.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Conger, the difference is part for the retention and disposition part of the law. Whether it is publicly accessible or not is a moot point. It still would require a retention period to be written before it could be destroyed by the public entity. And whereas the access part of the law would then, under the exemptions, would say that if it was attorney-client privilege, would be exempt from disclosure. So there is a difference in that we have, the State Archives has a broader, realm over setting retention and disposition over anything that relates to the public body's business, whether or not it is accessible or to the general public. So we still have to manage the records that are being created, or received, or sent by the public entity.
Following up on Representative Congress, because I'm not seeing you jump up there, in example of his opinion that he wrote for his client, I'm just guessing, but I don't know, that particular type of document wouldn't be necessary to satisfy the fiscal, legal, or administrative, or historical policy requirements of the needs of the public body. And I don't know if we actually have a sort of a description of who determines what's necessary, I think, is
you know, I guess sort of leading up to his issue, perhaps, what is necessary and who makes that determination?
Mr. Co-Chair, if Representative Conger was a public attorney working for the city or whatever, then that letter would be a matter of public record. If he was a private attorney advising his client on a decision that the city had made but it was never submitted to the city, then it's not a public record because it never went into the custody of the public entity.
But that's not what this says. I mean, and maybe it's because this amendment would it doesn't say anything about being in custody of a public entity.
Mr. Co-Chair.
So I see there's a couple others that would like to come up and engage in this conversation with you, Representative Conger. Seeing that we have a few more minutes, I'd like to invite up somebody from the somebody else who would like to come up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Barry Pack, Deputy Secretary of State, to hopefully try to clarify for Representative Conger's question around custody. The statute, while the definition of a public record in the amendment is clear and has, as you've read and described, keep in mind that it fits into an existing statute that defines custodian. And if you look at the printed bill, House Bill 2244, in ORS 192.410, there is the definition of custodian, and there it is explicitly that a custodian means a public body mandated directly or indirectly to create, maintain, care, or control of a public record. So that's where the distinction is made, that it has to be within the custody. The assumption is that through the definition of custodian, and perhaps the Judicial Department will bail me out if I'm making this more confusing than not, but by definition of custodian, in the definition that it is inherent that the public body must actually have the document for it to become a public record.
The two definitions, I wouldn't conclude by reading those that it's necessary for a custodian to have possession of the public record. My concern is that the definition of public record is broad, and even reading those two together, and I appreciate the point that you're making, even reading those two together, it's not clear to me that somehow a public, you know, something that is privately in a private party's possession wouldn't become a public record without being submitted under this definition. And I'm not sure that that's a significant concern. I know that this amends, or I'm sorry, the definitions are limited to ORS 192.410 and 192.505, so I will offline look those statutes up and find out what they relate to find out how this definition plays out in those other statutes. Maybe it becomes irrelevant because it's only dealing with archiving, but if the definition of public record here would extend to something relating to obtaining that record, then I guess I would have a concern about that. But I won't waste the committee's time dealing with that.
Thank you. Well, you raise an interesting question that I find interesting. I appreciate that. I do have some comfort in the word custodian, but I appreciate your willingness to talk to the Secretary of State's office offline and see if there's, you know, a legitimate concern. I think there may be one there, but I'm not positive at this point. So, Representative Wisnett.
Mr. Chair, I remove my motion to accept on the dash two to allow Representative Conger and our Secretary of State's office to work this out. As someone has experienced adverse effects from interpreting intent of legislation, I hope we can, you know, make it clear that there's very little interpretation of the intent. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate Tim bringing these questions up, because this is more and more of our information and things about us become public. I think this is real important. So I would move my recommendation to move the dash two.
So I'm taking that as a motion. I'm trying to figure out what motion it is at this point. But I believe Representative Wisnett has moved to amend his motion
withdraw it.
And withdrawing that emotion. So I'm not positive whether or not we can do that or just go through and stand at ease for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
The committee on House Committee on General Government Consumer Protection from recess. We're reconvening. We're still in public or in work session on House Bill 2244. Representative Wisnett has requested to withdraw his motion of adopting the Dash 2 amendment dated to 2511. Is there any objection to that request to withdraw the motion? Seeing none, it is withdrawn. And with that, I apologize for the slow. I just wanted to make sure we did that correctly. And perhaps we can have a conversation with Representative Conger and the co-chairs to make sure his concerns are addressed. I'm not convinced that they are not addressed, but he does raise a question that I think we need to take a look at. So with that, thank you very much for this and for your testimony, and I will close the work session on House Bill 2244. So, with that, let's try opening a work session on House Bill 2246. Jan, will you give us a description of this bill, please?
Yes, chairs and committee members. House Bill 2246, it is also a bill from the Secretary of State that we heard in a public hearing back February 10th. The bill extends confidentiality to any person making a call to the government waste hotline, allows a person making a report of state waste, inefficiency, or abuse to waive their confidentiality. It allows the Secretary of State to forward an allegation to another public body unless the person making the report objects. It provides that the investigation and any determinations made are confidential until the investigation is complete. It allows the Secretary to disclose a brief summary when allegations are unfounded, and it allows local governments and service districts to establish hotlines with similar processes. We have the Dash 1 amendments before us, requested by the Secretary of State, and it provides that all documents, information, or other records following the completion of an investigation or determination not to investigate beyond an initial investigation are disclosable public records except for the identity of the reporter. It removes the provision allowing the Secretary, when an investigation is determined to be unfounded, to disclose a brief summary of the allegations and determination.
Thank you, and I'm sure the Secretary of State's office is anxious to come up and testify on this particular bill. And if you'd identify yourself for the record again, please.
Co-Chair Hovey, members of the committee, my name is Gary Blackmer, Director of the Audits Division in the Secretary of State's office. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in favor of this amendment. We had met with representatives of the Department of Justice regarding their bill, which had to do with a records access, public records access, and they had provisions in there around the hotline, and based upon conversations that we had with them, we agreed to the changes as put forth in this amendment. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Can you again describe what the changes in
sure.
the amendment
Essentially,
are?
Essentially, what the co-chair Hovey, members of the committee, the changes allow our work to be disclosable at the end of the investigation, or if we choose not to investigate and just conduct a preliminary review, at that point, that information would be disclosable. We would still maintain confidentiality of the caller, unless the caller had waived that confidentiality, and that's really the major extent of the change.
Thank you, and I don't believe that we got a motion on this. technically, I need to have a motion. So.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2s into House Bill 22, Dash 1s into House Bill 2246.
Okay. Representative Wisnant has moved the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments dated 2-25-11 be adopted into House Bill 2246. Further discussion. Any questions? Not seeing. Representative Smith.
And to your understanding, this would not increase or decrease necessarily the number of calls to the hotline or do anything sort of fundamental to the hotline, but just rather give the caller an option of staying anonymous or not.
Co-Chair Hovey, Representative Smith, yes, this would, we would be able to provide confidentiality to anyone who wished to remain confidential.
Cool. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Blackmer, did you mentioned the other bill that you affects the Department of Attorney General's Department, but and did can you remind us of that and what that was, and did the lobbyist for the press, for the newspapers, was he involved in working out the Dash 1?
Co-Chair Hovey, Co-Chair Wisnant, I don't recall the House bill that the Department of Justice has put forward, which is an omnibus bill on public records. I don't recall the number of it, but it has a number of provisions in it on all aspects of public records, one being the hotline, and that's where we discussed with them the issue, and it's my understanding we also talked with the representatives of the newspapers around the issue of access, and this actually makes the information more accessible than it had been in the past.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments? Seeing none, thank you very, very much. The motion before us is to adopt the Dash 1 amendments, and could we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Clark?
Excused.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan?
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnik?
Aye.
Vice Chair Holden?
Aye. Dash 1 amendments having received the required votes is adopted to House Bill 2246. Excuse me. With that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2246 and open a work session on House Bill 2854. Jan, could you give us a description of House Bill 2854?
2854 was Representative Nathanson's bill that your committee heard. It is the motor pool bill. It requires Department of Administrative Services to establish policies, methods, and means by which it and other agencies by intergovernmental agreement will manage the motor pool resources. The committee adopted the Dash 1 amendments on February 15th, and that was to specify that the intergovernmental agreements being referenced were those that were establishing a motor pool for common use. And you have the Dash 4 amendment in front of you. Mm-hmm. That's okay. The Dash 4 amendment, Representative Nathanson requested it, is basically taking the emergency vehicles, the state police, out of the agreements for the motor pool. And the pilot program that is referenced in the bill will not be a pilot program with public safety. You also have the fiscal analysis that says Dash 5. That is because I went ahead and had fiscal prepare the analysis on the Dash 1 and the Dash 4 combined.
One and four is five.
Mm-hmm. They put the two together and they give you a 5.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 4 amended dated February the 21st, 2011 to House Bill 2854.
Representative Wisnant has moved the Dash 5 amendment dated, or the Dash 4 amendment, excuse me, dated 2/21/2011 be adopted into House Bill 2854. Discussion. And a clarification that we do not need to adopt a Dash 5 amendment.
That's correct.
Thank you for that. And I know Representative Nathanson is in the audience. I don't know if she cares to elaborate on the Dash 4. I think it's pretty straightforward.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I move House Bill 2854 to the floor.
We have to adopt the amendment first. So with that, can we have a roll call vote on the Dash 4 amendment, please?
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Clem?
Excused.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan?
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Holby?
Aye. The Dash 4 amendment having received required votes is adopted to House Bill 2854. Representative Wisnant.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2854 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Wisnant has moved House Bill 2854 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended and the bill be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference.
So do we still have the subsequent to Ways and Means on this bill? So the motion before us, discussion?
Could you just clarify what the last part of that motion meant?
That means that it does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and so the process for us is to, is if we're sending the bill out, that we send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and at that point it gets referred, subsequent referral takes place, and it is sent to Ways and Means Committee before it actually comes to the floor again for an actual vote.
I see.
It's
confusing.
It seems confusing, but the bills go back to the desk before and then go down to the next committee. So anytime there's a subsequent referral, it is referred to the floor with a recommendation and then re-referred
we won't committee. See it again until it comes out of Ways and Means.
Correct.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Explanation.
Yes, is a little bit confusing for some, including myself from time to time. So with that, no other discussion. Can we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flynn.
Excused.
Representative Conger.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan.
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith.
Aye.
Chair
Wesnitt?
Aye.
Chair
Holby? Aye. House Bill 2854, having received the required votes, is, dare I say, moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation
as amended,
and it is be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference, in which case it does not need a carrier. So with that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2854. Got through the agenda today. Appreciate the committee's indulgence and paying attention to some of these bills that are extremely interesting. And with that, I will adjourn the House Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection.